Next case is 05-2336, State of Ohio versus Paul Bueller. Ms. McGrath.
Good morning. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I'm Mary McGrath from the Cuyahoga County Prosecutor's Office on behalf of the state of Ohio, and I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Watch your time there.
Thank you. Your Honor, this court has determined that a conflict exists between the 8th District's opinion in State versus Bueller and the 9th District's opinion in State versus Wilkins. In State versus Bueller, the trial court denied the inmate's application for DNA testing on the ground that the inmate failed to prove that DNA testing would be outcome determinative. The 8th District Court of Appeal reversed the trial court's denial, finding that the trial court had prematurely denied the application and that the trial court was precluded from ruling on the application without the report provided by the prosecutor pursuant to Revised Code 295374, subsection C. In Wilkins, the trial court denied the inmate's application for DNA testing on the same ground, that the application was not, or I'm sorry, the DNA testing would not be outcome determinative. The 9th District Court of Appeal reached an opposite result as from the 8th District Court of Appeal and affirmed the trial court's denial of the application for DNA testing, finding that since the inmate had failed to establish a mandatory acceptance criteria set forth in RC 295374B1 or 2, the trial court need not go any further in its analysis, may deny the application for DNA testing, and not require the prosecutor to file a report regarding the condition and the existence of the biological material sought for testing. Here, Your Honors, what the state is seeking from this court is an opinion that where an inmate who is seeking DNA testing fails to satisfy either of the mandatory acceptance criteria set forth in Revised Code 295374, subsection B1 or 2, the trial court may deny the application at that point. The trial court is not required to proceed to subsection C, and the trial court need not require the prosecutor to prepare a report regarding the existence and the condition of the biological material sought for DNA testing. And the state relies on the following arguments to support this claim. Initially, Your Honors, the DNA statutes, it contain conflicting portions regarding what the state's duty is. 295373, subsection C, states that the prosecutor may, but is not required, to file a response to an inmate's application for DNA testing. Subsection D of that same section, 295373, states that the trial court shall make its determination to accept or reject the inmate's application in accordance with the criteria and procedures of 295371 through 295381. And then this subsection D goes on to articulate what the trial court must consider when making its determination to accept or reject the inmate's application for DNA testing. Subsection D states that the trial court shall consider all kinds of things, including the files and the records, as well as any response filed by the state, by the prosecutor, under subsection C, which is the subsection that's just told the state, you may, but are not required to file a response to the application. Under the subsection D, the trial court then may, if the filed records and application show that the application may be denied, deny the application.
You left out the words of the, unless the application and the files and records show the applicant is not entitled to DNA testing, in which case the application should be denied.
Yes.
Doesn't that take you over to 74? Isn't that, I'm helping you with your argument. I just want to make sure I'm understanding how these statutes work together. A lot of words here without the General Assembly ever telling us what the sequence is or what the order is.
And that, I believe, is where the confusion has come, and we are really seeking guidance here. But yes, Your Honor, you put it more articulately than I did. 2953-74 are acceptance criteria for DNA applications. So our argument is that the Ninth District's opinion should be adopted in that, let's read 2953-74. Here, A does not apply to Paul Buehler, but B does. And in 2953-74, an inmate is required to satisfy either B1 or B2 in order to have his application accepted. Here, when I responded to Mr. Buehler's application for DNA testing, I argued that his application should not be accepted because it did not meet the requirements of B1. Mr. Buehler was able to meet all the factors in B1 except for one, that DNA testing would be outcome determinative. And our argument is when an inmate cannot prove or does not, or fails in his burden really to show that his application meets these standards, the application may be denied and the trial court need not proceed to subsection C or even to any further portions of the statute.
Because your argument is, I'm going to make sure I understand you, because your argument is that there's no reason to put the state through the cost and so forth, all that's entailed with the DNA testing and recording, all that's entailed with DNA testing, unless it is going to make a difference in determining the guilt or non-guilt of a party.
Exactly, Your Honor. My argument is that the burden is on the inmate to satisfy the requirements, satisfy the factors, and this is set forth in 2953-74B. Inmate must meet B1 or B2. If he fails to do so, our position is his application should be denied, and the trial court need not proceed in its analysis to subsection C. C sets forth multiple factors that the inmate must meet, but it also contemplates that the state is then required to file a report finding the existence or not, or whether, you know, that they have done reasonable diligence to try to find the biological material, and to have the testing authority, a lab, actually test this biological material and determine whether it is any condition to be DNA tested, if it's been contaminated, if it's sufficient quantity. So yes, our argument is once that inmate fails to meet the mandatory acceptance criteria of either B1 or B2, the trial court need not proceed in its analysis.
Where does the right to appeal enter? Does a party have a right to appeal? Assume the trial court reads the statute the way you read it and decides that DNA testing would not, exclusion would not be outcome determinative, or either way. Is that appealable?
Yes, Your Honor, it is. It is in cases such as this where Mr. Buehler or any other inmate was convicted by a judge or a jury. In cases where an inmate has pled guilty or no contest to the underlying aggravated murder, that individual does not have a right to appeal if his application is denied. But here, Mr. Buehler did have the right to appeal, and under 29, I believe it is 5373, the trial court, when it denies the application, is required to put its reasons forward, and from that, the inmate has the right to appeal, which he did in this case.
So in this situation, if we were to grant your request and file that, find that you have to make an outcome determinative test first, the judge records those reasons and the defendant has a right of appeal from those reasons.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes.
Let me make sure I understand the argument too, because it's a little difficult for me to follow. You're saying the statute is ambiguous. That's your major premise, correct?
I'm saying that it's unambiguous when read as a whole and sequentially.
By reading it as a whole, we can make it unambiguous.
Correct.
Well, what about the word upon submission or when the applicant submits? That seems to me pretty plain language.
Your Honor, I will acknowledge that shall mean shall. And in subsequent portions of these statutes, the prosecutor shall file this report. Right. My argument is that is in conflict with an earlier portion of the statute that says the prosecutor may, but is not required.
Well, it says may make a response. Those two duties aren't identical, are they? I mean, you could respond to other things other than the material that's in the report.
Well, we're not responding to what's in the report. Response means response to the inmate's application for DNA testing.
So I'm saying that those two duties, the discretionary duty of may respond to the application and shall make a report, are not identical. So where's the inconsistency or the conflict between the two?
Because when we file our reports as to the existence of the DNA or of the biological material, that is part and parcel of our response to the inmate's application. Our argument is also that here, where Mr. Buehler failed to prove that DNA testing would be outcome determinative, whether the biological material that he seeks for testing exist or is any kind of condition to even be tested has absolutely no bearing on whether it will be outcome determinative.
I understand the logic of your argument, that common sense and logic would tell you don't do a vain act.
Correct.
I understand that. The point I'm trying to make is that doesn't the statute, or doesn't the legislature rather, have the right to set up a scheme that says, okay, you're going to do extra work. It's maybe not what we would ask you to do if we were in charge, but it's a legislative function. It's not the function of this court to omit or add language to the statute when it's plain and says upon submission of the application.
Yes, it does say that. My response to that would be, that is why we're here today. The portion of the statute that says the prosecutor shall file this report comes after the portion of the statute that says, first of all, the prosecutor need not even reply, but also that the inmate is required to satisfy mandatory acceptance criteria. And our argument is, and I'll adopt what Judge Corrigan said in his dissent, if the inmate has failed to show that his application has merit, why force the state to go to the time and the expense of preparing a report, trying to find this material? Sometimes it is very easy to find this material. Sometimes it takes days and weeks of digging through files.
What you really seem to be saying is that the legislature made a mistake. This was an oversight on the legislature's part. Is there a test for us
exactly
that we use when we become involved in correcting that oversight? I haven't seen that in your brief or heard it in the argument.
Your Honor, I don't know if there was a test, but I would agree with you that this was an oversight. And what makes me think that is subsequent portions of the statute, specifically 2953, I believe it was 77 and 78, when they talk about the chain of custody that the state is required, they then add the language once the application is accepted. So certain things that the testing authority does, that the state does, are to be done once the application is accepted. And I'll fully acknowledge the portions that say, okay, state, you've got to file this report regarding parent sample, whether the biological material even exists, is not conditional upon the application being accepted. But subsequent sections that deal with the same matter do include the language upon acceptance of the application.
Thank you.
Thank you. If there are no further questions, I would ask that the certified question be answered in the affirmative. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. McGrath. Mr. Foley.
Good morning, Your Honors. Chief Justice, may it please the Court, James Foley for Paul Buehler. I'm with the Office of the Ohio Public Defender. I want to touch on something that Ms. McGrath just was talking about, the distinction between pre and post 2953-77 provisions in the statute. She's right. 2953.77 starts with the language upon, you know, if an application is filed and if it is granted, thus and so shall be done. Prior to that in the statute, it's upon the filing of an application by an eligible inmate, a number of things will happen, one of which is the state shall go look for the evidence and file a report about the existence of the evidence and the condition of the evidence. That language is not ambiguous, not in the slightest. And this court has said on a number of occasions that if we're trying to find out what the legislature meant, we should read the language of the statute. We've done that. And that's all we're asking for here today, by the way, is that the statute be applied as written. There's no ambiguity, thus there's no need for interpretation. And this notion that statutes must be read in sequence is novel. I can't find any support for it in any case anywhere, and I made a big deal about that in my brief because I hoped that the state would come back and explain to me where this new canon of statutory construction came from.
I may agree with you on that point. I'm not sure we want to bind ourselves to a principle of law that we look at statutes sequentially, because we'd wind up with a dark hole, I think, in some cases if we did that. But in 74, the difficulty I'm having with your argument, Counselor, is in point 74B, if an eligible inmate submits an application for DNA testing under 73, the court may accept the application only if one of the following applies. And one of those onlys is the inmate shows the DNA exclusion would have been outcome determinative at the trial stage in the case and so forth.
Right.
Work me around that. How do I get around that? That seems pretty clear to me.
Well, actually, I drafted a piece of statute and then put it in my brief to show what the General Assembly might have written if they wanted this to be done in a particular order,
right.
If the court was required to make a determination about whether an exclusion result would be outcome determinative before 2953-75 kicks in, if you will. They didn't do that. There's nothing in there about the timing. All of these things can happen at the same time. The state's optional response, I think Judge Harris is exactly right, that response goes to the merits of the case. If they want to file a response about the merits, they can, but they're required to tell us what evidence is available, and that makes perfect sense, Chief Justice Moyer.
Point 77, the premise of point 77 is the application has been accepted, isn't it?
If I said point 77,
You did say 77, that's why I wondered.
I misspoke, I mean point 75.
The
state's obligation under point 75 is triggered by the filing of the application. 73 does say it's got to be outcome determinative for the application to be granted and for testing to begin, and I don't disagree with that. It's just a question of when that determination has to be made, and more importantly, whether that has anything to do with the state's duty to look for the evidence. The legislature apparently decided that it didn't.
Why would the legislature require the trial court to perform a vain act and squander judicial resources? What's the logic behind that?
In fact, it's not judicial resources that are being squandered, if anything's being squandered. It's the resources of the prosecutor's office who have to go look for this evidence and find it. But as between the pro se inmate, and this legislation was plainly written for the pro se litigant, and the state of Ohio, who's always had access to this evidence, and it's their own fault if they didn't put it somewhere they could find it later, the General Assembly has obviously made a choice and said, it's up to you to tell us what evidence is available. At page 3, footnote 2 in my brief, I actually make a point that the recent Senate Bill 262 legislation is irrelevant to the case. I was wrong about that upon further review. It actually says that the determination of whether an exclusion result will be outcome determinative shall be based on all available admissible evidence. Now, unless that change in the statute is to be interpreted as all available admissible evidence except for the stuff that we haven't told the state to go look for yet, which is ludicrous, doesn't make a bit of sense, I think the legislature is emphasizing that the state is supposed to go out and get the stuff first, and that the decision about whether or not an exclusion result would be outcome determinative is to be based upon the results of that search as well as the facts of the case.
I guess that's the point that I wanted to, you do think, I guess, that the decision of whether it's outcome determinative can't be made independently, or usually wouldn't be made, or generally wouldn't be made independently of the evidence?
It's the inmate filing the application doesn't know what evidence there is. Posit a 1984 trial. This gentleman is sitting in prison now in 2006. He has some recollection about what the evidence was that was admitted against him at trial. He doesn't know about evidence that wasn't admitted against him. The state might know about that. He doesn't know what's available. He doesn't know how to argue it. If the state comes back and says, we have items of evidence 1, 2, 3, and 4, and our inmate only knew about 1, 2, and 3, 4 turns out to be the piece of evidence that sets him free, then I guess it's a good thing we had the state go look for it in the first place. If there's a balancing of the equities to be done here, the General Assembly has done it. And if there is a balancing of the equities to be done here, let's err on the side of exonerating the innocent person who's incarcerated. This court, I was just watching the tape of the argument from Sterling. I believe, Chief Justice Moyer, you made the point that cost ought not be our primary concern in this milieu, that we should be concerned with getting the testing done and finding those people who are innocent in prison. I think the General Assembly agrees with that.
Counsel, let's turn to the language of the statute again. And I note that in this whole area where we're talking about 29-53-73, the same prefatory language is found if an eligible inmate submits an application. It's found in 29-53-73-C and D, and in Section 74, in Section 75, in
right.
Section 76, in Section 81.
Right.
Couldn't that suggest that it means in a situation when this happens, rather than, as you're suggesting, that it's a everything has to happen at once when the individual submits an application? When you look at 5375, that seems to me the problem area, because if you look at it literally, I think as Judge Harsha was suggesting, that starts again. If an eligible inmate submits an application for DNA testing, the court shall require the prosecutor to look for this evidence. However, it seems to me that, you know, you're talking about cases that may be very old. Any individual in prison could file a motion of this type. And very clearly, the General Assembly has said, under 74B, we're going to require certain things to happen before the court's going to submit this, before the court accepts the application. And really what we're saying here, if the court accepts the application, then the court shall require the attorney to use reasonable efforts. I think is that what you're saying, that
we would have to
rewrite the statute?
You would have to rewrite the statute to come to the result that the state wants you to come to today. You'd have to either adopt this notion of sequential reading, and even that doesn't get them all the way there. Accepted means accepted. There's going to be testing. It doesn't mean filed. It doesn't mean submitted. If you read the language, in fact, there's that the distinction between everything before 77 and 77 and then on. The language is if the application is accepted. So it's not a question of once the application is accepted, then the order shall go on. The trial court shall order the prosecuting attorney to search for evidence. The language is plain. Upon the submission of an application by an eligible inmate, they couldn't have been any more plain. If there was a desire on the part of the General Assembly to require an outcome determinative decision before the state is supposed to locate and catalog and identify this evidence, the General Assembly could easily have said so. That's why I drafted the sample legislation and put it in my brief. They could have been clear about it. They couldn't have been more clear. This court has said that shall means shall unless it doesn't, and the circumstances in which it doesn't mean shall are limited and inapplicable here, and the state never argues any different in its brief. They never argue this is ambiguous. They never argue that shall doesn't mean shall. All they argue is that this is the result we would like, please give it to us, and they don't, in any event, Judge Corrigan's dissent, the Wilkins decision, and the state's brief, none of them point to any authority for the result that they're after.
What's the significance of the fact that 0.75, the first sentence says, if an eligible inmate submits an application for DNA testing, under Section 29.53.73, go back to 73 sets out, as you know, the procedure for filing, but it then refers to 74. And 74 gets us again into that language that I quoted to you earlier, that you have to, has to be outcome determinative. 75 seems to me to be a statute that says if there's going to be a search by the prosecutor, this is what the prosecutor has to do. All these items listed. This is what you have to do, prosecutor, if the court tells you that I want the DNA test.
And the court's supposed to tell them that when the inmate submits the application. It's plain language.
Well, except that but the application refers to point 73. It takes you right back to point 73.
Every time that's, if an eligible inmate submits an application under 29-53-73,
right.
That is, as the Chief Justice has just said, the section defining the submission of an application. It's simply referring you to the section under which you file.
We have to look at the relevant portions of 73, which take you to 74.
If you're going to adopt this, the canon that says we have to read this thing in order, I can't stop you from that. There's no authority for it.
No, nobody can, I guess.
I can't. But the language of the statute's real clear. I tried to write something that if the legislature wanted the result the state wanted, they could have said that. It would have been easy to say, even if they just wanted to add a few words to 75, Instead of upon the submission of an application by an eligible inmate, it could be upon the submission of an application by an eligible inmate and after it has been determined that an exclusion result would be outcome determinative. That's one clause.
But it isn't upon. Yeah, it isn't upon the submission. And what you're suggesting is much clearer. If it said upon submission, the court shall. But right now it says if an eligible inmate submits an application, which goes back to my earlier point that this is just the precatory language of here's what we're talking about. And as the Chief Justice has pointed out, within 75, which is your strongest argument, I think, within 75, you have to go back to 73 and read that, which then refers you to 74. And I think the sequential argument then becomes clearer if we look at the language of the statute.
If the language of the statute leads this court to conclude that it has to be read in order, then that's what this court will conclude. I conceded this to everyone I've talked to about the case. If we want to create a rule that says we read things in order, then the state's probably going to win here. But that's not what the statute requires. It's plain that it says the prosecutor is going to go out and look for this evidence. It uses the word shall. And in the amendment, it makes it even more clear because it directs the trial court to make its outcome determinative decision based on all available admissible evidence related to the subject inmate's case. Now, if that means everything that's here before we go send the prosecuting attorney out to tell us what evidence is available, okay, I don't think it can possibly mean that.
Counsel, you argue in your case that one reason that you should not accept the state's position is that despite the appearance, you have an argument that you believe you can assert that this could be outcome determinative. Can you flesh that out a little for me?
Absolutely. You know, my point was just that the certified conflict question concerns only the statute and that the 8th District hasn't ruled on whether it would be outcome determinative. If an exclusion result is found as to the material that was under the victim's fingernails, the way the case is described in Rodney Hedrick's testimony, and he's the state's key witness, without him they have nothing. His description of the attack is that my client is supposed to be holding this woman in the front, and in fact the 1987 opinion of the 8th District says this. Judge Corrigan's dissent gets it wrong and has him coming from behind. That's not true, and that's not what the trial court feels. He's holding her, he's supposed to be struggling with her. Hedrick is supposed to come up to the attic and he's supposed to have told Hedrick, get that hammer and hit her. Hedrick's supposed to have come around this way. Now I'm Paul Bueller and I'm holding the victim. Hedrick's supposed to be over here. He says specifically, she never even saw me hitting her. He beats her down with the hammer, so he says. My client is the one that's supposed to be struggling with her, okay? She falls to the ground unconscious, and it is at that point that my client is supposed to have picked up the hammer and completed the job, as it were. Hedrick's the one with scratches all over his arms at the time that they were arrested. My client has no marks on him. There are no wrinkles on the victim's shirt. There's no corroborative evidence to that story. And if this stuff under his fingernails turns out to not be my client's, and it won't be, it finishes off his credibility. And if he has no credibility, there is more than a reasonable doubt about my client's guilt. It kills the state's case. And so, yeah, we do have a good argument about whether it's outcome determinative. It's just that arguing about that at this particular point in time is premature.
Do you have any right to ask or force the state to test the material to determine who it did belong to?
That's the point of the application. Actually, the amendments to the statute do provide for third-party testing. In this case, whether it matches Hedrick or not doesn't so much matter, even though the trial court, in the course of denying the application, said, I'll assume that it's Hedrick's and you still lose. As long as it's not Paul Bueller's, then Rodney Hedrick's story is destroyed. And if Rodney Hedrick's story is destroyed, he has no credibility. The jury can't possibly decide the case on the basis of his testimony, and my client is acquitted.
Do you agree that in any situation, as counsel for the state said, that these decisions by the trial court, the outcome determined decisions, are appealable?
Oh, absolutely. Well, the court just heard Sterling, and right. We're talking about when a guilty plea, that you can't appeal that. But a trial case, the denial of an application in an inmate that went to trial is absolutely appealable. That's plain in the statute. There's been no question about that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Foley. Ms. McGrath, you've saved almost 2 minutes of your time.
Thank you.
I'm concerned about, I mean, I'm interested in counsel's statement that that sometimes this DNA evidence may assist the court in determining whether it's outcome determinative, that the court may, in some situations, the court may not be able to make the decision of whether it's outcome determinative. Is the answer to that where the court can then ask for the DNA evidence, or what?
No, Your Honor. Outcome determinative is the inmate's burden to prove. The existence and condition of the biological material is totally separate and unrelated to the inmate's burden to show that DNA testing would be outcome determinative. You do not need the biological material to show whether testing would be outcome determinative. Here, our argument was two men are convicted of beating this woman, Joan O'Brien, to death. Paul Buehler saw the blood that came from underneath the victim's fingernails for DNA testing. It was Paul Buehler's burden at the trial court when he filed his application to show that DNA testing of this blood would be outcome determinative. Outcome determinative meaning if Buehler was excluded as the source of this DNA under this poor lady's fingernails, and had that information been presented at his trial, there is a strong possibility that no reasonable fact finder would have found him guilty. In other words, the jury would have had to ignore all the other evidence against Mr. Buehler, which was Mr. Hedrick's testimony that they both beat her, and additional other evidence. Paul Buehler put on an alibi, which was obviously rejected. Paul Buehler and Rodney Hedrick were caught days later in the victim's vehicle in West Virginia with her money, with her television. There was other evidence, not just Rodney Hedrick's testimony. So Paul Buehler's burden to show that it would be outcome determinative has absolutely nothing to do with whether the material even exists or is in a condition to be tested. And regarding Mr. Foley's statement that, well, too bad, State, if you have lost this evidence, first of all, we're going back sometimes in these cases 20 to 30 years. It was a different time. Lots of this material was not even recognized as evidence 20 or 30 years ago. It was discarded. Or it was never even submitted because at that time it wasn't evidence.
But we're statutory construction. We're not concerned about that.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
And one final note, if I may, regarding testing of third persons. The legislature did change the law in 2006. It used to be that the inmate would be tested against the parent's sample, what was recovered from the scene or from the victim. Regardless of the outcome, testing stopped. Now, in 2006, that was changed. The BCI can now feed those DNA results into the CODIS system, into the data bank of all the DNA. And if they get a positive result, they will let everyone know. But it does not require that Rodney Hedrick is deceased. Even if he were alive, he is not required to be tested. So in this case, testing would cease unless it were fed into CODIS. It is not as though, okay, Paul Buehler, you've come up. It's not you that we're going to go and test Rodney Hedrick. I believe I've used my time.
Thank you, Ms. McGrath.
Thank you very much.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. We'll take a brief recess.
All rise.
Mm.